Okay, what about the argument from design and the God of the gaps, the so-called God of the gaps argument? You're probably asking yourself, what is the God of the gaps argument? Well, when Christians give scientific evidence for the existence of God, atheists usually come back and say, well, that's just a God of the gaps argument. You're not basing your argument on what you know. You're basing your argument on your ignorance. Science hasn't discovered that, yet. But eventually when science does, your God won't have a role there anymore. So as science continues to roll along, we're closing the gaps where God used to be used as an explanation. And eventually, God will be out of the picture. You won't need God. Well, this is the way David Mills puts it. He says, as a historical observation, each step forward taken by science has further distanced the hand of God from perceived intervention into natural laws. As humanity's gaps of knowledge were slowly replaced by scientific understanding, a God of the gaps found fewer and fewer caverns of intellectual darkness in which to live. You see what he's saying? Think about it like this. Okay, people used to believe that Zeus caused lightning. Now we know it's weather formation, it's electricity. There's no bearded deity in the sky who causes lightning. That gap was closed, and some kind of extra natural, supernatural explanation wasn't needed. They used to believe that this naked man used to hold up the earth, Atlas. Well, since we've gotten satellite technology, we know there is no deity holding up the earth. The earth is just floating through the vacuum of space. And so atheists argue, this is just a God of the gaps. Eventually we're going to figure it out. And how foolish will you be at that point? In fact, some Christians argue this as well. We should keep science and theology separate because we're going to get embarrassed here, guys. Keep it separate because once they prove it, we're going to look dumb for saying that, you know, God caused that or whatever. Here's Michael Shermer. He's a skeptic. He says, whenever an apparent gap exists in scientific knowledge, this is where God interjects a miracle. Intelligent design advocates argue something like this. X looks designed. I can't think of how X could be designed naturally. Therefore, X must have been designed supernaturally. That's basically the argument from people who believe in a designer. Well, I think we need to look at several different arguments to explain the so-called God of the gaps. We can't just look at one or two. Let's really delve deeply into this subject, okay? Let's consider a first argument. The claims of the Bible repeatedly clash with modern science. You know, we should keep science and theology separate because, you know, the Bible is always clashing with, you know, what science is always clashing with Scripture. And we should really just keep these two things separate from one another. Well, that's half true. Sometimes there is a tension between what Scripture teaches and what science teaches. Of course, we can point out maybe it's because we're misinterpreting Scripture or we're misinterpreting science. However, there are other cases where Scripture was not falsified by science. Instead, it was verified by it. As we said back in week two, for millennia, the Judeo-Christian worldview stated that God created the heavens and the earth in an instant. And Stoicism, Greek thought, Aristotelian thought, skeptical thought, all the way up until the 20th century said, you guys are fools. Don't you know that the universe has just always existed? It's always been here. It is, it was, it will always be, to put it in the words of Carl Sagan. Well, modern physics and cosmology discovered that this was not true. It discovered that the universe had a beginning in the distant past. Now, there's a reason why people don't believe in Zeus anymore. That's because Zeus's divine effects are explained naturalistically. Likewise, Atlas, we don't need him because we can explain that. However, we do need a cause for the creation of the universe, and we've already made that case. If you want more details on that, you'll have to get that teaching. However, we can put this in contrast to other world religions. You know, while the Bible has been confirmed in multiple different ways, Taoism and Hinduism both state that the universe was eternal. So in this case, the Christian worldview was verified. These other worldviews were falsified. Okay, what about a second argument? The second argument, the gaps in scientific knowledge have been closing due to scientific discovery. Eventually, supernatural explanations will be rendered unnecessary. Well, at face value, when you read that, you think to yourself, that's kind of true. I mean, science has been progressing. We are learning a lot more about the natural order. There's a sense in which that's true. However, there's a sense in which that's absolutely false. There's certain gaps in scientific understanding that have not been closing, but they've been opening over the last 50 years. Here we want to differentiate between scientific experimentation and scientific explanation. While the experimentation of our world has increased, this has only led to explanation decreasing. For instance, the origin of the universe, the physical law, fine-tuning of the universe, or the origin of first life. This scientific evidence, the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of physical law, and the origin of first life, is what got notorious atheist Anthony Flew to become a believer in God. Okay? If you don't think that this is good evidence, then you have to talk to Anthony Flew about it. Anthony Flew, in 2007, Anthony Flew wrote the book, There Is a God. He said this on page 155. The only satisfactory explanation for the origin of such, quote, end-directed self-replicating life as we see on Earth is an infinitely intelligent mind. Guys, this guy wrote on the philosophy of religion. He was atheistic for decades, okay? Went around the world debating people, saying there is no God, there is no God. And as the scientific discoveries were starting to accumulate, he changed his mind, became a believer in God, and wrote a book about it, saying that the best explanation for this is an infinitely intelligent mind, to put it in his words. He also says, I must say again that the journey to my discovery of the divine has thus far been a pilgrimage of reason. I have followed the argument where it has led me, and it has led me to accept the existence of a self-existent, immutable, immaterial, omnipotent, and omniscient being. Now, if you don't think this is good evidence, then why have some of the most notorious atheists on planet Earth in the 20th century changed their mind on this evidence? So while we're experimenting and understanding some of these gaps, we're not getting any closer to explaining these gaps, and that's the difference. In fact, the more we experiment and study these phenomena, the more it shows how little of a naturalistic explanation can be in line. Okay, let's think about argument number three. Historically, Christians have claimed that God was responsible for phenomena that modern science has later explained away. Haven't Christians done this in the past? Haven't they said that there was, you know, such and such a thing that God did, and then we find out that there was a naturalistic explanation for it? Well, what's our response to that? Well, I guess we could respond by saying this should cause us to be careful in saying God caused such and such a thing, but it shouldn't stop us from claiming that there is some kind of divine intervention in certain areas of science. To put that another way, while some theistic explanations have been historically wrong, while some have been wrong, this doesn't mean that all theistic explanations are wrong. Think about that logic. Think about if we applied that to any other area of knowledge. Well, the weather forecaster was wrong on Tuesday. He said it wouldn't rain, and it did rain. Therefore, he's always wrong. Well, what about a physician? Once in a while, she fails to diagnose her patient. Does that mean that she will always fail to diagnose her patient? Okay, let's put this a third way. Hasn't naturalism been wrong in some of its explanations over the last 200 years of modern science or longer? Well, of course it has. No field of explanation has been right on every single thing. You know, imagine if somebody said some scientists have been wrong in the past about scientific theories. Therefore, all scientists are wrong about all scientific knowledge. That just simply doesn't follow. That's illogical. So while some Christians have made kind of bonehead ideas on God creating when he didn't, this should just cause us to be apprehensive. It shouldn't say that God did not create at all. Well, someone will say, well, eventually these things will all be disproven anyways. Eventually science is going to explain it and overthrow every theistic explanation that there is. Okay, hypothetically that's true. But hypothetically, every scientific theory we have could be hypothetically overthrown in the future. We can't go based on hypothetically what could happen. We need to go based on the current evidence that we have to date. So I think it just simply doesn't follow. Okay, what about argument number four? Supernatural causes do not apply to science. Science, by definition, only deals with natural causes, not with supernatural causes. Here's the way Michael Shermer describes it. I hope this will explain what he's this argument. He says, if advocates of design eschew all attempts to provide a naturalistic explanation for life, they abandon science altogether. There is no such thing as the supernatural or the paranormal. There is only the natural, the normal, and mysteries we have yet to explain. So to say that God did it, well, you might think that, but it's not science. Science has to do with studying natural causes and natural phenomena. Once we bring God into it, that might be interesting, but it's no longer science. Sorry. Well, I guess the response to that would be, you're basing your argument on what happened based on the definition of science, not based on the evidence. So you're not looking at the scientific evidence. You're opting out of design based on the definition. Well, that's not fair. You're basically saying you can't play because by definition, that can't be the case. Okay, think about it like this. If we're going to deny possible supernatural causes, then we are admitting that we are no longer looking for the best explanation. If we're going to deny supernatural, we're saying we're not looking for the best explanation. You know, if their assumed criterion is false, if there is such a thing as the supernatural, and the supernatural can enter into the natural, then it's not the evidence that's the problem. It's their assumed criterion for what science is that's the problem. So they're excluding it based on definition, not based on the evidence. Now, it might be a little bit confusing. Let me see if I can give you a simple analogy. Imagine if I go home tonight and on the magnets on my refrigerator, a buddy and I are going inside to grab something to eat, and I go up to the refrigerator, and my buddy reads the magnets, and on the magnets it says, honey, I won't be home for dinner tonight. You can eat without me. And so I turn to my buddy, and I said, yeah, let's grab some food. My wife won't be home tonight. And my buddy says, well, are you sure your wife did that? You know, I'm sure there's a naturalistic explanation for these magnets being in this order. You know, I'm sure it was gravity, or maybe the wind blew in through the window, and it ordered them in that way, and that's why the magnets are up there. Well, you can see the evidence should be open to interpretation, both from my view, that I think my wife did it, or from his view, that it was just a naturalistic explanation. But what if he said, you can't use your view because by definition, the magnets can only be ordered by naturalistic causes, not from personal causes like your wife. Well, if that definition is false, we could be falsely interpreting what's up there on the fridge. So while this theory might be the best naturalistic theory, he might think it was some gravity or earthquake or hurricane theory that got the magnets that way. It's not the most plausible theory. You see that? Okay, let's think about this for a second. Here's a picture of the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon. How did that come to be? Did God do it? I don't think so. I think it was erosion, wind, water, whatever. Okay. Now, by contrast, let's look at Mount Rushmore. Now, what if somebody said, there couldn't have been an artist that did that. It must have been erosion, water, maybe a really big hurricane. It just happens to look like those presidents up there. I have no problem identifying which one was a natural cause and which one was a personal cause, an intelligent cause. Do you? Now, the best response to this that I've heard is from Michael Shermer's book, Why Darwin Matters, where he points out that there is a rock enclave that looks like JFK, okay, that they found in the natural order. I'm going to show you a picture of it and see what you think. There's something to it. I mean, it's kind of clever. You can see his hair, his forehead. Okay. You know, does anyone think that that was supernaturally caused? Well, that's kind of his point, you know. But, okay, the difference between that being at the right angle, at the right time of day, and Mount Rushmore? Are you kidding me? Okay, we could debate over whether that's naturally or personally caused. However, I don't think it's a fair argument. I mean, when we're talking about the origin of the universe, the organization of the universe, and the origin of first life, we're talking about something way more complex than rocks falling in the right order. And we're going to get to that later on. So I don't want to belabor that point. Okay, what we should say is when we're investigating our world, we shouldn't set up arbitrary definitions of science and say you can't play because science means this. Well, what if naturalism is false? What if there really is a God who can intervene into biology and nature? Then we'd be excluding God by definition, not by the evidence. So we shouldn't be asking ourselves, is this the best naturalistic explanation? We should be asking ourselves, is this the true explanation? Is this really what happened? How do we know we aren't excluding the true explanation simply because of a naturalistic bias? What we might say is if science has limits, which theism can explain, why can't God be a part of that explanation? Well, some Christians have presupposed, they've adopted naturalism. I think this is a big mistake. It's a huge mistake. They've presupposed that God's work in nature is so clever, so disguised, that looking at that and just natural causes are indistinguishable from one another. Why would we ever assume that? You're a Christian. You believe God does miracles. You know, ask yourself, what was the best naturalistic explanation for the resurrection? There is no naturalistic explanation. The Spirit of God raised Christ from the dead. We believe in a miracle-working God. I don't think we should just assume he doesn't enter into human history. We can point out that theistic explanations do not disagree with science. They don't disagree with the scientific facts. Instead, they disagree with the interpretation of the facts. So it's not anti-scientific to say that we want to propose God as a cause. What we're saying is we agree on the science. We agree on the dating. We agree on the experimentation. We're just disagreeing on the cause of the data, not the data itself. To put that another way, we're not engaging in physics. We're engaging in metaphysics. We can use science to back up a premise in a philosophical argument for God. Let me give you an example. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist, is a premise in a philosophical argument, a metaphysical argument for God, but it's backed up scientifically. So we're not dealing with God of the gaps. We're actually dealing with metaphysics, not with physics. Moreover, atheists also offer philosophical explanations for things that they can't explain. This subject on the origin of life, if we were to have atheist Richard Dawkins up here on this stage and we asked him, what's your explanation for the origin of life? He doesn't have one. He does not have a scientific explanation. So he offers philosophical explanations. And I'm not going to get into his explanation. It's the anthropic principle, which we've already studied, and I don't want to belabor that point either. But the whole point is, Dawkins is pointing the finger at a believer in design, and he's saying, oh, it's God of the gaps. You don't understand, so you're saying God caused that. Couldn't we just point the finger back at him and say, it's naturalism of the gaps? It's atheism of the gaps? You're explaining things that you cannot prove, you have no evidence for scientifically, causes that you can't prove, And you're inserting them into these phenomena which are unknowable. So you're basically taking another leap of faith, exactly as Christians are. We're trying to say which cause best explains it. And there's a difference between reasonable explanations and unreasonable. Some skeptics, naturalists will say, you know, well, if we start letting supernatural explanations into science, well, we're going to be bringing in unicorns, fairies, leprechauns, and anything else. Let's just keep that weird, creepy door shut. Don't let any supernatural explanations in. Let's just keep it naturalistic. Because if we start letting supernatural explanations, they could start being unreasonable. Well, here's the point. Why would we ever think that would be the case? Okay, when we're saying that a cause, an intelligent cause, caused the fine-tuning of the universe or the origin of first life, we're not saying any explanation can explain that. We're saying one that has intelligence, just the base, raw form of intelligence. Now, if somebody said, well, I think it was a leprechaun with magic power, I would say, how do you know that the cause is 3 foot tall? How do you know he has a green jacket? How do you know he has a pot of gold? Well, I don't. Well, then how do you know it's a leprechaun? Well, I don't. It's just some kind of intelligent cause. Thank you. We're just talking about some kind of supernatural cause. You don't know the specifics. You might know the essential attributes of the cause. You do not know the extra attributes. Just like if a thief came to your car, threw a brick through the window, stole your change and your stereo system, you wouldn't know the race of the thief, would you? You wouldn't know the age of the thief. You wouldn't know the gender of the thief. But would you be able to know that a thief broke into your car? If the cops came to your door, if they showed up at your door, you think a thief broke in? Well, I don't want to presume it was a thief. I mean, I can't explain everything about the thief. I don't know his race, gender, age, favorite color, favorite show on TV. Well, you don't know all those extra attributes, but at least you can know the essential attributes. Someone broke into your car. And that's all the argument from design is saying. It was some kind of designer. One more. Argument number 5. If we allow supernatural causes, this will destroy scientific progress and scientific discovery. Well, this has happened. There are some creationists who have distorted science, have messed with science. I think it's ugly. That's happened. However, on the other hand, historically speaking, science hasn't been hindered by Christians. It's been helped by it. It's been furthered by it. Some of the greatest scientists in the history of science were Christians. Let me give you just a few. Copernicus. Copernicus celebrated astronomy as, quote, a science more divine than human. Boyle, he was a devout Anglican who believed scientists were divinely appointed priests of the book of nature. What about Newton? Newton wrote about biblical prophecy. This guy was not a deist. He was a Christian. He wrote commentaries on biblical prophecy, including long commentaries on the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. He wrote, quote, this most beautiful sun of systems, system of sun, planets, and comets, could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. Kepler, he wrote this, for a long time I wanted to become a theologian. Now, however, behold how through my effort God is being celebrated through astronomy. Well, these creationists, boy, they'll just ruin science. These guys helped science. Lemaître was a Belgian astronomer. He was a Catholic priest. Mendel worked on heredity, helped Charles Darwin develop his theory of evolution. And he was also an Augustinian monk. And there's just a host of other people. I think that is an absolutely ignorant statement to make. It's just not true that Christianity, supernaturalism, a Christian worldview is going to hurt science. Historically, theism isn't a science stopper. It's a science starter. And many people argue that science itself was birthed out of a Judeo-Christian worldview. Argument number 6. Supernatural explanations are outside the realm of cause and effect. Without the regularity of cause and effect, science becomes impossible. Now, this argument is a little bit different from the earlier one. It doesn't say that supernatural causes of design are outside the definition of science. It just says that science would be cluttered if we started allowing supernatural interventions. You know, imagine if you were running a a study and somebody could come in and mess with your test tubes and your data. Science would be impossible. And so if we say that supernatural explanations can enter into the realm of cause and effect, then this would bring major problems for science. Well, in response to this, Norman Geisler, as a Christian philosopher, has a pretty concise way of explaining how to answer this objection. He distinguishes two different types of science. The first one is operational science, and the second is origin science. Now, supernatural explanations would in no way affect operational science. Operational science is based on empiricism, observation, and repeatability, just the normal laws of nature. Here, Christians and naturalists should have no disagreement. God created the laws of nature, and we should be able to study and observe and make repeatable, testable hypotheses. By contrast, origin science is not empirical, observable, and repeatable regarding the laws of nature. This is what could be called a forensic or speculative science. For example, when a person is killed, we can't repeat the murder. It's not as though there can be the laws of nature will always happen and that person will be killed. However, we have to take all the evidence and basically see if someone was responsible or see who was responsible. So origin science in regard to the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of physical law, and the origin of first life, this can't be seen in a test tube. We weren't there. We have to speculate forensically to see how this thing happened. To put that in a concise way, John Lennox explains that a Ford car runs on natural law, but it wasn't created by natural law. It was created by an engineer. So cars run on natural law, but they weren't created by natural law. So when dealing with non-repeatable singularities like the origin and fine-tuning of the universe, we need to engage in forensic science, not empirical science. We're trying to come up with the best explanation. Some people call this the multiple competing hypothesis approach. You have multiple different possibilities. Was it Professor Plum with the candlestick? Was it Colonel Mustard with this? You have multiple competing hypotheses, and you try and finger the right one. So it's origin science, not operational science. This deals with singular events, not with regular events. Okay, miraculous acts of God do not change natural law. Some people say, well, if God can intervene into nature, wouldn't that just muddle with science? Well, by definition, miracles are rare. If they weren't rare, they wouldn't be miracles. That's what a miracle is. So to say that God could interfere once in a while would in no way do away with operational science with the regular cause and effect realm of the universe. So to give you an example, imagine if an apple was hanging precariously from a tree, and as the stem started to weaken and the wind blew, natural law dictated that unsupported objects like that apple would fall and hit the ground. And yet, as I was standing there with my cat-like reflexes, I reached out and grabbed that apple before it hit the ground. Would that mean that I was just interfering with natural law? No. A personal agent can intervene into the natural cause and effect matrix of the world. It's not a contradiction of natural law. It's a suspension of natural law temporarily. And if God truly is the creator, if this is his universe, we're on his real estate, then he can enter into the cause and effect matrix of the universe anytime he wants. Okay, argument number 7. Personal and intelligent causes violate the uniformity of cause and effect. Without the uniformity of cause and effect, science falls apart. Well, this is kind of similar to point number 6. However, I think a few more points can be made. By inferring a supernatural cause into nature, we're not disregarding the uniformity of cause and effect. We're affirming it. That's where many people are confused. Well, if we're doing science, we need to base it on the uniformity of cause and effect, natural causes, and we need to keep that stable. If we're saying that something could interfere with that, then that would no longer be the uniformity of cause and effect. That's not the case. By affirming design, we're affirming something that we're used to, that we see every day. We're affirming something in the past that we see in the present. We see design in the present. When I see those magnets up on the refrigerator, when I look at those magnets, I know that's the result of design. My wife put the magnets in that proper order. If I were to see a specified sequence like that in the past, I could also infer design. Now, the concept of specified complexity, not just that it's improbable, but that it's specified and orderly. Not just that there are some magnets up on the fridge, but that they form a code, a language up there. It has a specific order. This field of study is used in other sciences. I don't know if you realize that. It's not permitted in biology, but it's used in other sciences, such as cryptography, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial life, forensics, archaeology, and intellectual property protection. Who was it? Vanilla Ice, when he stole the riff from Queen? How come when Freddie Mercury and Brian May from Queen said, "You stole that bass line from us," how come the judge didn't say, "Well, maybe you guys both just randomly came up with the same bass riff"? You know, that's really only one or two notes that's described there. And at the time, Vanilla Ice said, "Well, theirs is do 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 do. Mine is do 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 do." And so mine's a little bit different than theirs. They were like, "No, you're getting sued for that. Plus, you're talentless, and you should probably get sued just for being talentless." Anyhow, cryptography, SETI, intellectual property protection. In these cases, they are using the same exact criterion for discerning design as they would do in biology. Jodie Foster in the 1990 movie Contact. Jodie Foster in the film works for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And from space, they get a code. And guess what was in the code? The first 20 prime numbers. They got 20 prime numbers in a row. Numbers that are only divisible by themselves in one. That's what a prime number is. In the film, Jodie Foster blows her top. She's like, "We've found alien intelligence." To this day, the SETI program uses this criterion that if you find specified complexity, that's a sign of intelligent life on other planets. And yet, researchers like Paul Davies, the agnostic, will use that criterion for detecting alien life. He won't use the same criterion for the origin of life in DNA. DNA is vastly more specified and complex than the first 20 prime numbers, by the way. Argument number 8. Theistic explanations are not scientific because they only offer negative evidence. Okay, by this, well, let me just read some of the critics. Michael Shermer, in Why Darwin Matters, writes this, quote, "Disproving evolution does not prove creationism." Okay, if you say evolution isn't true, that doesn't mean God did it. You can give a lot of negative evidence for why evolution isn't real, but that doesn't mean that the alternative is true. Maybe something else did it. Maybe there's another explanation. So you can't just disprove naturalistic explanations. You have to give a positive case. Darwinist Francisco Ayala, he writes this, quote, "If one explanation fails, it does not necessarily follow that some other explanation is correct. Explanations must stand on their own evidence, not on the failure of their alternatives." So we can't just say that, well, naturalism can't do it, therefore God did it. That's the argument. Well, in response to this objection, this argument, we could make a few points. First, negative evidence isn't conclusive, but it's still good evidence. Okay, it doesn't conclude the alternative, but it's still good evidence. Imagine if I pulled out my cell phone and was talking and said, "Hold on a second, I'm talking to someone on Alpha Centauri right now." Okay, well, Alpha Centauri is trillions, light years of miles away. Okay. That would mean that in order for a signal to reach from Earth to Alpha Centauri, there would be an enormous time gap where we could talk back and forth. Now, if I offered that negative evidence and said, you know, the speed of light only travels at 186,000 miles per second, and that's light years away, there's no possible way you could be talking to someone on Alpha Centauri. Okay, that wouldn't prove the alternative, but it would be good evidence against their claim. It would show the limits of their claim. So I think it is good evidence. And moreover, we can point out that by inferring design, we are not arguing for something that we don't know. We're arguing for something that we do know. You infer what's naturally caused and what's intelligently caused every day, every hour, every minute. Okay? Every time you read a code, every time you read a screen, every time you look at a billboard, you are constantly differentiating between what's naturally caused and what's designed, what's intelligently caused. There's nothing spooky about intelligent causes. The fact that we're communicating one intelligence to another, that's intelligently caused. There should be nothing surprising about this, or nothing unscientific about it. Grutheis is a Christian apologist. He writes, the design inference is not based on ignorance of the natural world, but knowledge of it. We're able to differentiate between the two. Okay, well, what about objection number 9? Aren't there design flaws in nature? Aren't there some examples of things in nature that would not be the result of design? Here's what Ayala writes. He says, quote, the imperfection of structures is evidence for evolution and contrary to the arguments for intelligent design. So, you know, if there's design flaws, wouldn't that preclude a designer? He says this, consider the human jaw. Because we have too many teeth for the jaw's size, wisdom teeth need to be removed. And orthodontists make a decent living straightening the others. Would we want to blame God for this blunder? A human engineer would have done better. It's a perfect, morally flawless God who created these things. You know, Shermer asks, why would an intelligent designer have built the eye upside down and backwards? You know, the panda's thumb, the curvature in our spine. There's so many different design flaws that it makes you wonder. Ayala is actually a Christian believer, but he fully disagrees with any kind of intelligent cause or divine cause outside of naturalism. And he says, I just don't want to blame God for those causes. Okay, so what about design flaws? Well, first, the argument from design doesn't give evidence for the goodness of God. It gives evidence for the greatness of God. Okay, now there's a distinction there. We're not trying to prove that God's good by seeing design in nature. We're trying to prove that God is an intelligent being who can design. You know, it'd be like asking, how does the argument from design demonstrate that Jesus rose from the dead? It doesn't. That's a different argument. There's an argument for that. But most philosophers and apologists use a cumulative case. They use many arguments. There's not one all-sufficient proof for God. There's usually a cumulative corporate case for God, just like in a courtroom. Second, even bad design proves design. Even poor design proves design. Here's a picture of a medieval torture rack. Now, the person who designed that was evil, yes? But wouldn't we say that someone still designed it? Would anyone here say, well, whoever made that was evil, therefore it wasn't designed? That would be absurd. Of course someone designed it. Now, we might not know the moral character of that being. It might raise a bunch of different questions. But when we're just focusing on design, that's a whole host of other questions that theology can deal with. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about this. I think about my first car. It was a Chevy Prism, a 1995 Chevy Prism. Don't laugh too hard. I drive a 98 Chevy Prism right now. But that car was a junker. I mean, it was so difficult to get that thing running, keep it running. it was poorly designed. Would I say that it wasn't designed? No, but just that it was poorly designed. So even bad design still implies design. Third, some designs turn out to be good after all. Some supposed design flaws in nature turn out to be good with time. A classic and recent example of this is junk DNA. Junk DNA is the extra DNA that's in the genome. It's called junk DNA because it doesn't code for proteins. It's just kind of excess leftover stuff. And naturalists, when they first discovered it, just said, this is extra. It has no purpose. Why would a designer care to put extra filth in the genome that doesn't mean anything? Well, recently we've discovered that some of the stuff in junk DNA actually does have a function. It's not functionless. Some of it doesn't. We're still discovering that. But sometimes supposed design flaws have explanations down the road. Fourth, some trade-offs in design cannot be avoided. Okay, if you're engineering something, should you engineer it for speed or for size? If you engineer it for speed, that's going to necessarily lower the size of the thing you're creating. Here's the way Dembski describes it. He says, our view of design is shaped too much by sports competitions. We always want to go faster, higher, stronger, and longer. But do we really want to go faster, higher, longer, and stronger without limit? Of course not. It is precisely the limits on functionalities that make the game of life interesting. He points out if the predator was perfectly engineered, optimally designed, then the prey would be in trouble. And likewise, if the prey was stronger, then the predator wouldn't be able to eat and it would die off as well. Fifth and finally, some biological systems are not designed but have mutated. Darwin was right. There is mutation, random mutation, and natural selection. That is verifiably true. When the human genome copies itself, there are mutations. Those mutations produce some that are stronger, more fit. More fit meaning that they give off more progeny, more life, and some don't. So what we should ask is, what was the original design, not what is the current design? It would be like looking at a 2012 Corvette and saying, well, that's optimally designed. But what happens when it rusts and goes bad 30 years from now? Well, it wasn't the way it was when it was created. Well, in conclusion, without a doubt, design surrounds us in the realm of biology. As one advocate of intelligent design put it, he says, you know, naturalists feel comfortable saying that God might have intervened in cosmology. He might have intervened in physics because that's deism. That means God created the universe, and okay, that's fine. Deism and naturalism are not that far apart. However, once we enter into the realm of biology, that's where the metaphysical temperature goes up. That's when it really starts to bother people that God could be involved. But needless to say, design surrounds us. Skeptic Michael Shermer openly admits this. This is on page 65 of Why Darwin Matters. He says, quote, the design inference comes naturally. The reason people think that a designer created the world is because it looks designed. I think we should quit tiptoeing around this inference and admit that life looks designed because it was from the bottom up by evolution. So he says, yes, it does look designed, but it was not a conscious designer, not God. It was just the natural process. If we could just sum this up into a closing statement, we could put it this way. While deists and naturalists believe in the uniformity of cause and effect, that everything can be ascribed to natural law and physics, Christians ought to believe in the uniformity of cause and effect in an open system. We believe exactly what they do, but they believe it's closed, whereas we believe it's open. God can intervene into that. I don't know how we could read our Bible and not affirm that. God intervenes into space-time history. Okay. Any questions? Yeah. It could be cases of mutation. I think the irony that Bill Dembski points out is he says, you know, the eye is supposedly so poorly designed, and yet we see out of it. He says it's ironic that they're arguing this so much. They're looking at their computer typing this argument on eyes that work fine. So there's a certain irony there. Yeah, sorry. That's a great point. There's been a host of articles that I've read where they begin, like with the butterfly, with the hummingbird. The exquisite design of the hummingbird, they'll actually look at that as the model that they should use to create something similar. So it really, there is a certain level of hypocrisy involved there. Yeah.